for, just be mindful of the timeframe. Podium does go up and down. If you haven't been here for a while, if you need to adjust it. And please state your name and the party you're speaking on behalf of before making your argument. Appellant counsel, when you're ready, go ahead.
May it please the court, Attorney Taylor Rahm here on behalf of the appellate. Good morning. And after doing several of these on Zoom, it's nice to officially be back in person here in front of the panel. I'm asking this panel to reverse the convictions against the appellant, or in the alternative, remand to the district court level, requiring them to allow appellant to present not only a defense, but a full and complete defense. It's well established under the Constitution that a criminal defendant in a criminal case has the opportunity to not only present a defense, but it's to be full and complete. And they are allowed to present their own evidence that would make the state's case have some sort of pushback. It's not enough to just say, well, you have a right to defend, get up there and say, state didn't prove their case. You also have the right to present your own evidence. And in this case, the evidence that the defendant wanted to, or appellate, excuse me, wanted to enter was reliable, it was competent. There was no one disputing that it existed.
Well, let's assume that's so. How would the victim's previous attempted suicide by drug overdose bear on the question of whether Mr. Surlis beat her with his fists and his feet and with the walking stick?
It's relevant, Your Honor, because the theory of the defense, which was explained to the district court, was that she again, this a month later, attempted suicide and ended up with injuries. If you look at the prior one, she tried to commit suicide via drug overdose. She ended up in the hospital, and she had injuries to her body. Now, there was a
I understand your theory. You're trying to say that the injuries that are on video, the body cam and so on, you're trying to say that the extent of those injuries were because she did it to herself. Another suicide attempt? Is that kind of where you're going at with this?
That's correct.
But with that said, the district court made credibility determination after credibility determination, and we don't reweigh the evidence. How do we set those aside?
Well, I would respectfully disagree in regards to the credibility determinations. I think the district court made the determination that the evidence wasn't relevant. It wasn't that they were disagreeing that this prior suicide attempt occurred. There was no testimony from the victim laying out, you know, specifically what occurred on a witness stand to be opened up to cross-examination to test what really occurred. So my understanding from the district court was their ruling was it wasn't relevant.
And if but relevant based upon the point that I believe Judge Warkey's making and that I was inquiring about, is it's relevant if the injuries that she suffered were somehow consistent with a drug overdose. And I'm trying to get a sense. I'm assuming you saw the photographs in the record.
Correct.
Explain how a drug overdose would be consistent with what appeared to be significant bruises on the backside of the victim's upper thigh, that consistent with being struck with a walking stick. How would those wounds and the fingerprints on her neck, how would those wounds have been consistent with your drug overdose theory?
Well, first, I guess dispute there was no evidence that presented that the marks, you know, were consistent with fingers, finger marks, and the bruises all over. As
I thought, I read in the record that there were, in fact, it appeared to be, from the medical record or from the officer, what appeared to be thumbprints on her neck. I'm certain I saw that in the record. Am I misreading the record?
I don't believe there is anything from a medical standpoint. I believe the court's correct in regards to the police reports, that was their determination that it was consistent with finger marks. But there was no, you know, state was not bringing in any sort of medical or
You don't have to, do you? If some things are readily apparent. She said she was strangled. She described in her interview with the officer how the strangulation occurred with his hands on her neck, and there were prints on her neck that would have been consistent with with that explanation. So just though, just that injury by itself and the wounds to the back of the leg, explain how logically a fact finder would deem relevant a potential drug overdose.
Well, in addition to the drug overdose, which was included in the medical reports, not only was she suicidal, the way in which she said she wanted to commit suicide was either by hanging herself or throwing herself off a building. So certainly that was a violent way of one wanting to commit
suicide. So let's play with that a little bit. Explain how that works. So then the district court, seeing the wounds that she in fact suffered, would believe that she, what, tried to hang herself with something that appeared to be a handprint and then fell from the hanging and injured the back of her leg? I don't understand how that is even logical.
Well, I'm not suggesting that they would have to find that there was evidence that a rope was put around her neck, but certainly the way in which she was stating she wanted to commit suicide could produce injuries. One could throw themselves down a set of stairs and create all sorts of bruising on backside.
That may be true, but we have a victim, a witness, not a victim, a witness who's next door. She calls 911, and she part of your stipulated testimony was her report that she'd heard this domestic fighting or arguing going on next door. And again, this testimony from a neighbor certainly correlates what was on the body cam when the victim is saying, this is what he did to me. I mean, that's what I'm getting at about credibility determinations. How do we set those aside? The court found that the witness was accurate as far as her reporting, and it was timed out as far as when this injury occurred. And then we have the victim herself who talks about what happened. I mean, those are, you can't create two different theories when you have all of the testimony and evidence that's in the record that supports a determination of credibility.
Sure. Well, first, the way I read it from the 911 transcript from the witness was that she heard screaming. It wasn't that she heard banging or any sort of noise. It was a scream. And that's also contradicted, as pointed out, because the victim here told different, it's unclear whether at one point she said it happened on October 23rd. At another point, she said it happened on October 24th. At one point, she said it happened at 5 or 6 in the morning, which would be where that when that call came in. And at another time, she said it happened in the evening. Certainly, that's different. That was not an evening call from that witness. And there was nothing, again, from the witness stating that she heard a male's voice at that time or that she heard banging into a wall, which in an apartment building, if someone is having their head repeatedly smashed into a wall, certainly you would think that the neighbor would hear that part.
Well, the neighbor said the walls were very soundproof, which is why the neighbor was surprised. Neighbor was pointing out to the 911 operator that the whatever was happening was so loud, it surprised her that it would go through the soundproof wall. So I don't think your argument is consistent with the evidence, at least as suggested by the 911 operator, who in also identified a male who said there was a male who would frequent the place, and she believed that the male was there at the time.
And I don't think she described that the male was, in fact, there at the time. She did mention that a male frequently, was at that apartment. But I would just note if one can hear someone, screaming, you would assume a head banging against a wall 5 to 6 times enough to, according, to the victim, knock them unconscious.
Do you believe that's the strongest argument you have on appeal, is that the district court failed to allow your client to offer evidence that the victim had previously attempted suicide by overdose?
Well, I think all of the arguments are strong in regards to the evidence that was allowed in regards to the allegation of murdering an animal from a prior occasion. There was no actual charges against appellant.
Why would that matter?
Well, it's extremely prejudicial for fact finder to hear information about an allegation of murdering a cat.
Well, as I read the record, that information wasn't admitted in order to prove the truth of the matter asserted, that he had actually murdered a cat, but that he was referencing the fact that he murdered a cat while he was abusing the victim, so that it was it was part of the assault, part of the fear inducement during the assault. Did you see that evidence being introduced for the truth of the matter asserted?
Well, I saw the evidence being introduced to, which created an unfair advantage for my client in regard.
Well, that's not my question.
I mean, I think
it's not unfair, is it, if it's part of the assault? It's only unfair if it has unrelated to the assault and it's intended to speak to the character of your client. But if it's part of the assault, how is it unduly prejudicial?
Well, it's unduly prejudicial because it's not specifically that he just said that. It's the allegation that he, in fact, did murder a cat, and the court allowed it in under 634.
So you're saying that the court accepted that evidence in order to supply support for the fact that he did murder a cat, or included it as to consider your client's state of mind during the assault?
Well, I think what the court's motives were, I can't speak to, but what it...
Doesn't it matter?
It does matter. I'm not suggesting that it doesn't, but from the argument standpoint of if that comes in, how prejudicial it is. And again, it was allowed in under 634.
Wait, why does it matter how prejudicial it is? What if it's extremely prejudicial, but it's included as part of the assault? Well, it's not unfairly admitted into evidence, if that's the case. What if during the assault, your client said to the victim, I killed 1,000 people. Their bodies are buried all over the United States. And I'm going to do the same thing to you. And that's extremely prejudicial. You're not suggesting that somehow that's inadmissible if it's part of the, if it's admitted for the purpose of demonstrating his state of mind at the time of the assault, are you?
Not necessarily, but that's the court allowed it in again under 634, relationship evidence. That's how that came in. That was the state's argument of why it should come in. And that under Minnesota Statute 634, there are enumerated reasons why evidence, what types of evidence should come in, prior relationship evidence. There's nothing in there specifically about a pet or an animal. And in breaking it down even farther, I think even if
the argument really, though, whether the cat was a household member, it seems like the act of harming a person's pet is itself a type of act of abuse.
Well, I think, certainly it's abuse if there's someone.
And I'm not saying abuse to the pet. I'm saying that 634.20 applies if there's a prior act of abuse against a household member. And it seems that portions of your brief are arguing that that was an error for the district court to admit that under 634.20 because a cat is not a household member. And my question is that really the issue, or is harming a person's pet an act of abuse against the person, not the pet?
Right. I mean, it's certainly not an act of abuse against the person, clearly. I mean, it would be...
I don't know. Why is that certain and clear to you?
Well, I think there's a difference between harming someone, a human being, on one occasion versus on a prior occasion, an allegation of harming an animal.
If I'm trying to humiliate someone and torment someone and terrorize someone, and I kill that person's cat, don't you see an effect on the person, regardless of whether the cat is considered part of the household?
Well, I'm still getting back to the relevance of why that would need to be presented to a fact finder in regards to, whether or not it was...
Saying it's not relevant?
I don't think it's relevant, and the prejudicial value outweighs any probative value it has, because the question is, did appellate assault the victim? That's the question that was supposed to be asked, not whether on a prior occasion he assaulted a cat or murdered a cat.
If somebody destroys a person's property but does so in a threatening manner in the intent to cause fear in the property owner, and that property owner is a household member, right, it's not a prior act of abuse because the property is a household member. It's an act of abuse because in the act of destroying property, you're threatening a person. Isn't that the same way that harm to a pet could be seen as a threat to a person?
I mean, I guess one could look at it that way, Your Honor. I would still then argue that any probative value that would have would be outweighed by the...
So can I ask a question about that, too? I know your time is dwindling, so if you have other things to go to, I'll refrain.
Please feel
okay.
free.
So there's two types of prejudice. There's the prejudice that we look to sometimes in 403, 404B, potentially 63420, where you're looking at the prejudicial, the unfair prejudice versus the probative value. That's that goes to error in admitting the evidence. If the court incorrectly balances those two interests, that's error by admitting the evidence. That's a separate type of prejudice than appellate prejudice. In other words, was this admission something that affected the outcome of the case? And with a bench trial here, my question is, are you arguing that the district court erred in its balancing of the probative value and the prejudicial effect? Or, because that's what I thought you were arguing in your brief. I didn't see any arguments about whether or not the admission of that was something that affected the outcome.
Your time has expired, but if you could succinctly answer that question.
Well, I do think, I mean, to answer your question, the argument was that it impacted a fact finder. So the prejudicial value that it brought outweighed, or that it would bring, would outweigh any probative value it had.
So it sounds like you're still talking about error in admission of that evidence.
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have your 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Thomas Raggetts. I'm an assistant Ramsey County attorney, and I represent respondent, State of Minnesota, in this matter. My prepared remarks today are brief because this is not a close case. Under the undisputed standard of review, this court cannot overturn Judge Charles's credibility determinations. That's appellant's third issue. Appellant's second issue regarding the cat, it's important to point out here that he wasn't just charged with assault. He was charged with threats of violence. This was the threat of violence. This was part of the threat of violence. Judge Charles was not obligated to suppress part of the threat, take out the middle part that referenced the cat, and only leave the rest of the threat. That would have made it much easier to say, oh, this was just a joke. This was a misunderstanding. When the threat is, I killed your cat, and I'm going to kill you the same way, that's all part of the same threat.
Are we required to rely only on the district court's basis at trial for admitting the evidence if there are other admissibility bases?
No, Your Honor. The question here is not, did the judge explain her ruling correctly? The question is, did the judge reach a correct ruling? And clearly, on the cat issue, you don't need to reach the relationship evidence because this was just part of the direct threat. And no case law says you've got to edit the threat to make it less threatening. And also, to get back to Judge Bryan's point, you can threaten someone or abuse someone.
But what about this? The circumstances of this case would indicate that the harm to the pet was in fact a threat to the person.
Well, I think it's the way he said it to her. Like, I killed your cat, and I'm going to do the same thing to you. And clearly, to get to the example you used earlier, if you smash up someone's record collection to get even with them, and because you hate them, we don't have to demonstrate the record collection as a family member. You did something to the family member by hurting something they love. In this case, the cat, which may not even have been killed. There was no evidence here that this cat was actually dead or that appellant killed him. It was just part of the actual threat made. So that isn't really a close issue here either. That just leaves the overdose attempt.
Before you move on,
yes, please.
And I know it's less of an obvious point, but the distinction between the balancing test and an error that a district court could make in balancing these competing interests in order to admit that would be error, but still related to prejudicial impact of admitting something. That type of prejudice is different from the kind of appellate level prejudice that we look to. And as I read the brief, the arguments were purely about error in the balancing test. So I'd like to hear what your perspective is on that argument, whether the district court erred in its balancing test, assuming it had to do one, and secondly, whether there are any arguments that admission of that affected the outcome of the case, and if you do think there are, why do you disagree?
So I do argue, to answer the second part of your question, Your Honor, I do argue in my brief that there was no prejudice here, partially because it was a bench trial. And I cite cases, or at least one representative case in my brief, that says on a bench trial, there's less danger of the fact finder improperly using evidence. Because it's a judge, it's not a jury. And so there's less danger here that Judge Charles would have said, well, if he killed the cat, he's a bad person, he must have done this too. So that certainly goes to the prejudice. I mean, I think you don't even need to reach that because her balancing was not an abuse of discretion here, given that it's all part and parcel of the same threat. It's not like he threatens her and then 10 minutes later says, oh, by the way, I killed your cat too, or 10 minutes earlier. This is all part of the same sentence, essentially.
And in this case, the state wasn't offering evidence about harm to a pet that happened in the past in order to, you know, under 63420 specifically or 404B.
That's correct. The state never argued there's a pattern here. He hurt the cat, and then he hurt the cat's owner. This was just all came in through the threat.
Is there any indication in the district court's findings that the district court believed that the cat was dead?
No, I think the district court actually specifically notes that there isn't any evidence like that. And if you look at the district court's order, which I'll get to in a second to respond to some of your questions, Judge Ross, the district court focuses on the injuries, the body-worn camera video, the phone interview, the 911 call, all the evidence found at the scene. These are the things that influenced Judge Charles' credibility determination, not he's a cat killer. And we've already discussed that you can't overturn those credibility determinations, but there's no reason to think that the mention of the cat had a significant effect on those credibility determinations when you look at everything put together. And the physical evidence here is really key, and that goes to the overdose attempt evidence, because it's important to note here, appellant never offered any evidence that the overdose attempt resulted in bodily harm, much less substantial bodily harm like here. Yes, she overdosed, she went to the hospital, she was described as having injuries. Well, if you overdose, that's an injury in and of itself, I guess. You go to the hospital. But there was no evidence that she had any bruising or marks on her neck or anything like that from the overdose attempt. And, you know, it's appellant's burden to at least make an offer of proof that he has evidence to show some sort of pattern or similarity here. And it's also important to note that appellant didn't offer any sort of medical testimony saying, yes, these injuries from the attacks are also consistent with a suicide attempt. I mean, you'd be hard-pressed, I think, to find a medical expert willing to say that, given the thumbprint on the neck, given the injuries on the back of the thighs, all over the body. And Judge Ross, to get to your question about the factual findings, if you look at page 3 of the addendum with the findings of fact, Judge Charles found that photographs taken show a red thumb-shaped mark on the front of her neck. And appellants never argued that's clearly erroneous. Judge Charles also found specifically that the cuts and bruises on her left forearm, left and right thighs, her face, and bloody gash on her leg are consistent with the victim trying to defend herself from strikes by using her arms and legs to block the hits. Again, appellant has never argued that's clearly erroneous or any evidence to the contrary that somehow all this could have been consistent with throwing herself down the stairs, for example. So when you have those now undisputed findings of fact, there's no way to establish any sort of pattern here between an overdose and what actually happened to the victim in this case. So given the lack of any sort of pattern here, Judge Charles didn't abuse her discretion in excluding the evidence that the overdose was a suicide attempt. And just to digress again for a second, if you look at then defendant's memorandum in support of a finding of not guilty on all charges filed May 20th, 2022 on page 20 and 21, appellant does there talk about how the fact that the victim had earlier overdose and said she couldn't remember anything, and maybe that's what happened here too. So it's not like the evidence of an earlier overdose wasn't in front of Judge Charles. Clearly, it didn't cause her to think, oh, therefore the victim and the 911 caller aren't credible and all these injuries have some other medically mysterious explanation.
Now, the district court excluded the overdose evidence on grounds of relevance, if I understand the record correctly.
It excluded on grounds of relevance the fact that the overdose was a suicide attempt. But There was, in part, in the record, as evidenced by appellant's argument below, the fact that she had overdosed on heroin a month before and couldn't remember what happened. So appellant's argument was, well, same thing happened here. She overdosed on heroin, can't remember what happened. She must have done all these things to herself while she was on heroin.
The standard for relevance is pretty low. You don't have to show much to connect the attempted the proposed evidence with the case in order to show some probative connection. And the standard is pretty high for a defendant's right to provide a complete defense.
I agree with that, Your Honor, and that's been the thrust of appellant's argument, that he has a right to present a defense. But it can't be disputed that the rules of evidence still apply. That right does not mean, well, if this is the only defense he has, we must throw out the rules of evidence and let it in. And here, there's absolutely no pattern. If there was any sort of evidence that the previous suicide attempt had resulted in injuries remotely similar to these, or that these injuries could have somehow been the result of an overdose, or behavior that follows an overdose, that would be a different matter. But we have nothing like that in the record here. So, A, it's not relevant, and B, you still, even relevant evidence can be excluded if it's unfairly prejudicial, and this would have been unfairly prejudicial. I mean, it was basically an attempt by appellant to challenge this victim's mental health and suggest she's an unstable, suicidal person, and therefore you shouldn't believe her. So those are both grounds for keeping it out.
I think that's the argument. I think the argument wasn't that you shouldn't believe her because she's suicidal. I thought the argument was there's an alternative that her... I thought it was sort of twofold. One, that she was significantly on drugs at the time of the incident, affecting perhaps her ability to recall what actually happened, and she was suicidal and the injuries might in fact have resulted from something other than what she described. I thought that was the argument that was presented, not that she somehow was she was suicidal and therefore,
The argument has to be that she's not credible because she says, this is what he did to me. And so they have to be challenging her believability. And how the suicide goes to that, except for suggesting, well, she did something crazy before, so she probably did it again, and you shouldn't believe her, I don't know what other relevance there could be. And there was, in front of the judge, the fact that she was on drugs. So they didn't need the suicide evidence.
When you say unduly prejudicial, I mean, as I understand prejudice, it's to the parties, not to witnesses.
Well, it's prejudicial to the state to suggest that the victim shouldn't be believed because of her mental health issues. Just like it's prejudicial to say, you shouldn't believe this rape victim because look at all the men she had sex with in the past.
It's a little different than rape shield laws that are in place to specifically protect a certain category of witnesses.
Well, right, but that's also why we exclude access to medical records and mental health records unless you have a specific reason for using it, because there is still a stigma out there, in some circles at least, with people with mental health issues. And so to suggest...
But I don't think that's the prejudice. I mean, you're suggesting that the district court has to weigh potential prejudice to the state, and the prejudice you're asserting is, well, it may have made the victim look bad. And I don't think that's the analysis when it comes to deciding whether one party or the other is prejudiced by the admission of the evidence.
Well, I think that... prejudice to the victim's credibility can be prejudice. But I think ultimately you don't need to reach anything like that here, given that this evidence, there's no pattern whatsoever. And also, appellant still has the burden of showing prejudice here. And given all of the physical injuries here, the 911 call, and I wanted to get back to that too, because
before you go to that point, I'm kind of curious, like a bigger picture question of the right to present a complete defense. And where that runs up against a credibility determination of a fact finder. And I'm curious as to your view on how we can sort of demarcate credibility determinations when that is almost the defense, is you can't believe the victim, and if you don't permit the defense to present its theory, then that's violating the defendant's right. So where do we demarcate our standard of review for credibility determinations at the same time that we are protecting the constitutional rights of defendants?
There's a lot to unpack in that question, Your Honor, and I'll give it my best shot. I think the case law is quite clear that the rules of evidence apply always, and just because you're saying I have a right to present a defense doesn't somehow change the analysis under the rules of evidence. You still look at, did the judge clearly abuse his or her discretion in finding this evidence was either not at all relevant or whatever minimal relevance there was outweighed by the danger of confusing the jury, unfair prejudice, having a mini trial on a separate issue. These are all valid grounds where a judge can keep out evidence. And no case law says, yeah, but under a complete defense theory, you have to look at that differently or weigh things differently. So I really don't think you need to do any demarcation here. I think this is just a straightforward application of the rules of evidence.
Is it a rules of evidence issue or is it a sufficiency of evidence issue when it comes to the credibility of the victim?
Well, they kind of tie together here because one of the appellant's arguments here is the evidence is insufficient. And that you can easily put aside because you can't overturn Judge Charles' credibility determinations. Where it gets a little more interesting is the other two issues where arguably he's claiming that that affected her credibility determination. And if you found that, then it would go back for a new trial. If you find insufficient evidence, there can't be a new trial. But again, you could only find insufficient evidence is if you said, well, we don't find this victim credible even though the judge did, which obviously you can't do. So on the other two issues, you could theoretically say she erred in excluding this evidence and we're not sure if that would have affected her credibility determination, so we're remanding for a new trial. My argument here is under these facts, there's just no basis for that, given all of the physical evidence, given the lack of any evidence offered by the defense that the physical evidence was consistent with any sort of suicide attempt or anything like that, given the lack of any evidence that the previous overdose resulted in any sort of bodily harm at all. And since I have 9 seconds left, let me just point out quickly, if I may, that in fact, the 911 caller did say she heard pounding on the door around 4 a.m. and did say she heard KLD screaming, no, no, no. So this wasn't just some generic 911 call. There were specific facts here that Judge Charles found credible about what the 911 caller heard, which is consistent with the attack here, not consistent with the suicide. And I apologize for going over my time by a little bit. If this court has any additional questions, I just ask you to affirm Judge Charles.
No questions. You always go over time when you start out by saying, I've got very short remarks.
Yeah, so it goes.
All right, you have the last word.
I just want to start by touching on the fact that it was clear in the transcript that we were not offering the evidence to try to go after the victim's mental health. And that was clearly explained on the record why we were doing it. And I disagree with there's no pattern of evidence. You know, roughly 30 days before this alleged assault, the victim tried to commit suicide. That's not disputed. And then after...
I think the pattern question goes to attempted suicide in a manner that relates to the kind of injuries that she suffered here, so that I think that's the relevance issue.
Sure. Opposing counsel is correct. There was nothing offered by either side specifically what the injuries were, but we do know that there were injuries too. So there were some sort of injuries. Couldn't prove what they specifically were, but there's this.
So the question for us is: was it an abuse of discretion to determine that undefined injury in the past was irrelevant?
Well, I don't know that that's exactly how the court, you know, phrased it. I think the district court just found in general it wasn't relevant. And through the transcript, you see at one point the judge considering and even asking the state, well, why can't we?
It sounded like in response to Judge Ross's question, you're agreeing that the relevancy determination really does depend on how closely the injuries match, the injuries of a suicide match the injuries present here.
No.
And if that's the case, then it seems like we're really asking ourselves, was there an abuse of discretion in excluding under relevancy the evidence because there's not, it's undefined injuries as opposed to something more specific that then could match.
Sure. And if I answer Judge Ross's question implying that I believe that the specific injuries had to, you know, be proven to make it relevant, I apologize for that. That was not the point I was trying to make. Is we know that.
Well, let's go back to that then. Is relevancy really about how closely the injuries of the prior suicide attempt match the injuries of the present alleged assault? Is that what the district court looks to for relevance?
Not entirely. Certainly, you can look at the fact that there was a suicide attempt. She did end up at the hospital, and she was treated for injuries. That in itself should be relevant to show, and then after...
Relevant to show that she's making up allegations of an assault?
That it's that she could have, again, overdosed and created injuries to her body and, again, ended up at the hospital. And she has clearly has a hard time recalling many things that happened throughout this offense, as she's repeatedly says, I do not recall, I can't recall. And, again, the dates...
She does, but she's... I mean, I'm sure you watched the interview. She's very precise. There seems to be no confusion about what happened in the apartment. I mean, that's what matters. I mean, the fact that she wasn't sure if it was morning or evening, I mean, maybe that has to do with the fact that she was using drugs. Maybe not. But the fact that she had her head banged against the wall by your client, struck by the walking stick of your client, kicked, punched, that seemed to be... offered with a degree of clarity that wasn't clouded by the use of drugs, going to your argument as to credibility.
Yeah, well, she does give specifics, there's no question about that, but there are a lot of, again, I do not recall, I don't know, and then the dates being mixed up, the times being mixed up, there are inconsistencies, and certainly there are different arguments for why that could be. I think it's important when someone's under the influence to at least consider that could be why somebody is not credible, but I think what it comes down to this whole thing is two sides are supposed to be able to present their theory to a fact finder. Now, it doesn't mean the fact finder is going to agree specifically with what they put forward, but in this case, the state was allowed, they were going to be able to present their entire case, and the defense was basically going to, there was stuck saying, it's not credible, there's not enough evidence here, instead of actually really being able to present our defense that she attempted to commit suicide just like she had done before with drugs. There were drugs in her system. She ended up at the hospital again. There were injuries. And after the assault, she again was talking about how she was suicidal, specifically throwing herself off a bridge or a building, if one of those two, or hanging herself. So it was a violent way in which she wanted to commit suicide. We weren't allowed to present our theory, which is what, again, it doesn't necessarily mean that the district court had to say, well, we... in, you know, pretrial, that we believe or we think this is a strong defense, but we were completely gutted from being able to present that defense.
How does the fact that the same fact finder was the gatekeeper of the evidence, how does that bear on your argument, if at all?
I don't know if it has any bearing. I mean, the reality is this was a trial that was submitted to a fact finder, and we weren't allowed to, I'm out of time, may I complete?
Please.
We weren't able to fully argue our defense to the fact finder. Now, the court may have obviously heard the arguments prior. I mean, I shouldn't say may. She definitely did hear the arguments, but you would obviously give her the credibility that she set that aside when she went to make her determinations. That's what you would expect a fact finder to do. So I am asking this court to overturn the convictions or, in the alternative, remand and allow appellate to complete his defense and present a complete defense. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. The matters are deemed submitted. Decision will be issued in the statutory time frame. This court is adjourned.
All rise.